Good afternoon. Welcome back to the Conversations on Race and Policing. My name is Matt Patino. I'm an adjunct instructor of history at Crafton Hills College and a former police officer with the Rialto Police Department here in California. Before we begin, I would like to read our land acknowledgement. We recognize that California State San Bernardino sits on the territory in ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians, the Juhaviatam. We recognize that every member of California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American people and Indigenous people. I'll now turn it over to Dr. Murray.
Thanks, Matt. I'd actually like, before we get started, to briefly ask Michael German and Robbie Madrigal to quickly introduce themselves before I
Hi,
introduce our guests.
everyone. Thank you, Jeremy. Hi, everyone. My name is Mike German. I'm a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, and I previously served 16 years as an FBI special agent.
My name is Robbie Madrigal. I work in the Fowl Library, and I am responsible for programming and communications. And I've been on campus for 22 years.
Thank you, Michael and Robbie. And Mary just joined us. Mary, can I ask you to briefly introduce yourself and then I'll introduce our guest?
Great. Thank you, Jeremy. Sorry for my tardiness. My name is Mary Texera, and I have taught for a number of, I was going to say years, but it's probably decades in the sociology department at Cal State San Bernardino, and I am recently retired. I'm very, very happy to be here and welcome to our guests.
Thank you, Mary. And I want to also again thank you, thank Thin Lai for keeping us going with Tech Matters. And I also want to note one of our fellow organizers, Stan Futch, who is served 35 years with the City of Riverside Fire Department, a community activist and member of the West Side Action Group, who is also a tireless member of our organizing team, but just wasn't able to join us today. And I'm Jeremy Murray. I teach history in the department here at California State University, San Bernardino. To briefly introduce our guests and then to turn it over to them, I'd like to first introduce Dr. Roger A. Mitchell Jr., medical doctor, MD. He's a forensic pathologist, a fellow of the College of American Pathologists. He's chair of pathology and chief medical officer for the faculty practice plan at Howard University. Dr. Mitchell is a board certified in anatomic and forensic pathology by the American Board of Pathology and now serves as professor and chair of pathology at Howard University College of Medicine. He also serves as the chief medical officer for the Howard University Adult Ambulatory Care Center. He's the immediate past chief medical examiner for Washington, D.C., where he served from 2014 to 2021. Just before his tenure ended, as chief medical examiner, Dr. Mitchell was the only forensic pathologist in history to also serve in a dual role as interim deputy mayor for public safety and justice. He's also a widely published scholar and sought-after expert on a number of subjects, one of which, of course, will be the topic of today's discussion and the book Death in Custody that he co-wrote with our second guest. Dr. Jay Aronson, PhD, is the founder and director of the Center for Human Rights Science at Carnegie Mellon University and a professor of science, technology, and society in the history department. His research and teaching examine the interactions of science, technology, law, media, and human rights. Dr. Aronson spent nearly a decade examining the ethical, political, and social dimensions of the post-conflict and post-disaster identification of the missing and disappeared in collaboration with a team of anthropologists, bioethicists, and forensic scientists he assembled. This work built on his doctoral dissertation, a study of the development of forensic DNA profiling within the American criminal justice system. In his recent book, Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at Ground Zero from Harvard University in 2016, which analyzes the recovery, identification, and memorialization of the victims of 9/11 World Trade Center attacks, is a culmination of this effort. We will hear more about this recent work conducted with Dr. Mitchell in today's presentation. And we'll also be sharing faculty profile links for both Drs. Mitchell and Dr. Aronson, as well as links to their podcast, Official Ignorance, and the recent book, Death in Custody, How America Ignores the Truth and What We Can Do About It. And I also want to note that our guests chose to forego a speaking fee, and instead they generously are going to have these funds go to copies of their book for free raffle and distribution. So we'll give some away at the end of today's session, and I will also have some left in my office for those who inquire, and I'll drop my email into the chat later. Finally, thank you to the CSUSB College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, Dean Christina Hasija, and the CSUSB Libraries, and Dean Rebecca Lubas, and the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee. Please join me in welcoming our outstanding guests, Drs. Aronson and Mitchell.
Thank you so much. I probably should have put a stipulation in my contract that I got to be introduced first, because it's always hard to hear myself be introduced after Roger gets introduced. Because he's such an amazing person. So, but I'll still go on. Thank you so much for having us. I am gonna put my screen share on for just a few minutes. What we were thinking is that we would give a brief overview of the book and our argument and partly how we came to write it and how we met. Roger is going to talk a bit about his very long engagement with this topic, and give you some of the big picture policy changes that we want to see made. And then we'll open it up, to people who are with us, and we can certainly, riff on some of the things that we said, but, I think it's good to have a quick overview of what's going on. So, the core problem that we focus on in this book and the project is that we have no idea how many people die in law enforcement custody each year, whether that's an encounter with police on the street, during transport, or while in jails, prisons, or detention centers. All current counts are undercounts, and the scope of the issue is intentionally ignored by the very systems that are supposed to be tracking these fatalities. We cannot address this problem if we don't understand it. And so what we do in our book is we offer a practical and achievable solution to the problem. And I won't give away the full punchline, but the short punchline is we want to see a custodial death checkbox added to all death certificates, the U.S. standard death certificate, as well as local death certificates. And by the end of this hour, we want you to all be advocates for that policy change and for a whole host of other changes that we want to see that sort of begin from that moment of actually tracking these deaths in the public health system. All right. And I always like to point out that this isn't just two random guys getting on here saying we have a problem. This is a problem that that journalists and advocates have known about for quite a long time. Last year, almost exactly a year ago, there was a hearing held in Congress, where they pointed out that the current government counts for deaths in prisons and jails are massive undercounts. And it's so bad that not only is the problem a problem, but the lack of data is a crisis. And so this is something that that we've been working on for a long time, but it's not just us. To give you a quick sense of what's in the book, the book actually starts with lynching. I'll talk about why in a second. And then we look at early advocacy efforts to try and understand and to count and to document deaths in custody, particularly police killings. We then focus on the work of journalists to document this problem and how that some of those early efforts actually culminated in the Death in Custody Reporting Act of 2000. That act was reauthorized in 2014, but it's actually not being fully implemented. And the data that we're getting from it is pretty awful. And that was actually what the Senate hearing was about. We talk about the one state where there actually is pretty good death in custody reporting, and that's Texas. And we talk about why. Then we look at the challenges of documenting deaths in behind bars. And once we do that, we get into our big policy prescriptions. So this project actually started a long time ago. Roger, I'm going to let you come in and take over for a minute and talk about who Amadou Diallo is and what he means to you, and also the story of Earl Faison, who was killed shortly after Diallo.
Well, thank you, Jay, and I appreciate being here, and just for everyone calling in from Zambia. I'm really excited about the work we're doing across the globe on this subject of forensic medicine. But in 1999, I was a first-year medical student, and I was coming home actually February 3rd of 1999. So just 25 years ago, almost to the day, I came home and was having dinner between study, between coming from class and then going to study, and I like to watch the news. And so I watched breaking news. At the time, he was, you know, the same age as I, you know, I was born in 1974. And he was shot at, Amadou Diallo was shot at 41 times. He was hit 19. He fit the description. He was in the vestibule of his home in New York City, and he was reaching for his wallet when told to show his identification. He had entrance wounds in the soles of his feet, so he was on his back when he got shot. And so in February of 99, I just started med school in 1998, and had just left the FBI. And we have a colleague on this program that is done some years with the Bureau. I was one of the first Black men in FBI laboratories, left FBI laboratories, the DNA unit, because I wanted to study violence as a public health issue and thought the best way to do that was as a forensic pathologist. And then Amadou Diallo got killed. And I said, well, police violence should also be a public health issue. Soon after that, in April of 1999, Earl Faison was killed in Orange, New Jersey. He was actually living in Newark, and he was beat to death. And in the book, we talk about his story more than Amadou Diallo's, and we talk extensively about what happened to him and how he was beaten and how he was kicked, and how he was maced in his throat, and then how he died. And the medical examiner, who was the regional medical examiner in Newark, New Jersey, is one of the medical examiners there, called his case complications of asthma, and his manner of death undetermined. And that sent ripples through my consciousness as a young medical student. And shout out to all of the students here, right, that have an idea, that have an exposure, that have an interest, and you want to write about it. So that same year, I started writing one of the first papers on police brutality as a public health issue. And it was published in the Journal of the Student National Medical Association in 2000, less than a year later. And became the position statement on police brutality by that organization, and then got re-ratified in the late 2000s. And so still is the position of the Student National Medical Association now 24 years ago. And that was the beginning of the work for me. I wanted to understand violence, but particularly violence engaged in arrest-related deaths. But what we've determined through the work that Dr. Aronson and I have done is we've not just said that there's an issue with understanding deaths in the pre-custody phase or arrest-related phase, like we saw, like I described in Earl Faison or Amadou Diallo, but or George Floyd, if that's more of an example that you can relate to, It's also all of the deaths that are happening incarcerated individuals in the whole criminal legal continuum, from arrest related throughout the entirety of the time that they spend with the criminal legal system. And so the book talks through that and talks the importance about natural cases and suicide cases, just as important as the homicide. But we start off with the work of Ida B. Wells, and I'll hand it back over to Jay to talk about our first chapter and how our first chapter really lays the foundation for what the rest of the book talks about.
Thank you so much, Roger. So this project actually began back in 2017. Roger and I were both invited to give talks at the International Association of Forensic Sciences annual meeting and our biannual meeting. I can't remember how often it happens. And I was giving a talk on my work on identification of the victims of the 9/11 attacks. And Roger was talking about a temporary disaster morgue system that he had developed for DC, thinking that the most likely use would be a terrorist attack. It turns out that it had to be brought out during the COVID crisis, the early days of the COVID crisis in DC. But we both gave our talks, and at the end of the talk, we were just sort of engaging in some pleasantries and small talk. And I was kind of about to walk away, you know, nice to meet you, interesting talk, blah, blah, blah. But I had a question that had been bothering me, and I thought that Roger might know something about it. Part of the work that I do that wasn't mentioned in my introduction is on human rights documentation. And in particular, I had been involved in several projects that explored the use of video on social media and on the internet to document deaths in conflict situations and places like Syria and Ukraine and Mali and elsewhere. And as I was doing that work, I would occasionally, like all Americans, see a video of an instance of police brutality or even a police killing. And in my human rights work, one of the first things I want to understand is whether this is a one-off case or whether it's a systematic problem that happens in a similar fashion across a wide range of time and space. And you do that by trying to triangulate the video that you see with some data set that provides information about the frequency of violations. And I didn't really know much about the situation in the US, but I figured that Roger would probably know where the data set was about how many people die in custody, because this is a democracy. We're a functional democracy. We uphold and respect civil rights, not perfectly. So I just assumed it was there and maybe it wasn't easy to find. And so I said, hey, you know, Roger or Dr. Mitchell, I have this question. Where do I go to find the data on how many people die in custody every year? And he kind of looks at me and laughs and says, it's a long story. I'm really hungry. I came straight from the airport and gave this talk. Why don't you come with me while I get get something to eat, and you can have a drink, and I'll tell you the story. I had no idea that this was Roger's passion, that this was what he was working on, that this was the thing that really motivated him to do the work that he did. I just figured that he might know where the data was. To make a long story short, over a 2-hour conversation, he basically laid out the contours of what's now our book. And one of the things that he said to me during this conversation, as we kind of got into things, was, you know, Jay, I really want to know who the Ida B. Wellses of death in custody have been over the past 100 years. And I thought it was a kind of strange question, because I thought this was a data and human rights question. And I didn't really think of how a journalist like Ida B. Wells fit into that immediately. It became quickly apparent to me. But he basically wanted to know what he was asking was, who are the people who have been trying to push back against what we call official ignorance? Just like with police killings during the period of lynching, the federal government did almost nothing to try and figure out who was dying and who was actually killing people who were lynched. The local death investigation system functioned in the same way. Death at the hands of persons unknown. The idea that even when the lynchers brought the body to the coroner in the county, the coroner would still have no idea who did it, because these killings were being done in the name of the community to keep people in power, quote unquote, safe. And so that was the question that he asked me. I wasn't sure it was the right way of going about this. And I wasn't even sure if I wanted to write a book with Roger at the time. So we kind of went our separate ways after this conversation and kept on going. And at a certain point, I realized that I actually couldn't turn away from this topic, from this problem. And part of the reason was that because people were dying at the hands of law enforcement and the criminal legal system in my name, I am the person, I am the face of the population of people who are protected by policing at someone else's expense. And that really bothered me. And so I agreed to write the book after several conversations and after, you know, a bunch of other, a little bit of extra research. And so one of the first conversations that we had following up on this, issue of who are the Ida B. Wellses of death in custody was, we needed to start the book with lynching. And I was like, I don't really want to do that. I think that it's a complicated path from lynching to death in custody. And I think that that might open us up to criticism. And it's actually a different phenomenon, because lynchings are extrajudicial outside of custody. And we're actually focusing on deaths at the hands of the law enforcement system, of government officials. And so I didn't want to kind of confuse those. But Roger was insistent that this was the right way of going about it. And I said, okay, I'll go do some research. And actually, within a couple of weeks, I sort of felt like an idiot that I had ever questioned him. It turns out, and by the way, here's just I forgot that I included this in this one. So you can see here headlines of coroners actually being complicit in hiding or covering up these lynchings, these murders. And so one of the things that I found when I actually started doing the research is that it was because of Ida B. Wells and later the work of folks at the Tuskegee Institute and NAACP that we even knew how many people were dying in custody. Because there were no official records, we relied on journalists and activists and advocates to actually figure out who was dying. And that the collection of this data led in part to the decline of the phenomena in the, particularly in the American South, but also elsewhere around the country. And so data was actually crucial in leading to a decline in the number of lynchings each year. At the same time, there was something else going on. The other thing that was happening was that as the phenomenon of lynching, or as the practice of lynching, was kind of fading away in the American South, racist policing was becoming increasingly prevalent. And even more importantly, the death penalty, that capital punishment, was increasing. You can actually see the numbers of lynchings decrease and the numbers of people put to death by the criminal legal system increasing, particularly in the South, but elsewhere around the country as well. And so that really, those set of issues really convinced me that lynching and death in custody were part of the same story, and also that the investigation of those phenomena were part of the same story. And so the first chapter focuses extensively on lynching and efforts to document those instances. And so the second chapter in the book is really answering the question that Roger asked me, is who are the Ida B. Wellses of death in custody? And so we look at a variety of community-driven efforts to identify people who have been killed by law enforcement. This is the Stolen Lives Project that emerged out of the October 22nd coalition, if anyone has ever heard of that. Interestingly, Roger has this book when he's back at his office in Howard. He actually has this book on his bookshelf, and you can see it behind him, because this was a group of people who influenced Roger and who many of Roger's colleagues in the New Jersey area were actually part of this project. And so we go through these. We also look at the importance of journalism and journalists. So in the absence of good government numbers in the United States, we've relied on The Guardian, we've relied on Washington Post, and we've relied on an organization called Fatal Encounters, which is actually one person, among others. And so Washington Post is the is actually still doing this. They focus solely on police shootings. But one of the things that just astonishes me is that despite the focus that we've had on this problem over the past several years, a lot of people are still dying. The numbers are relatively consistent, but 2023 was especially bad. It suggests that we're not doing a good enough job. One of the other journalists who we focus on is Mike Masterson, just an absolutely amazing human being who made this his one of the core things that he focused on as he traveled around the country. Started in Chicago in the early 80s, was originally from Arkansas, went to New Jersey, spent time in LA. He was the San Diego County reporter for the LA Times for a while, and then ended up at the Asbury Park Press in New Jersey. And he was one of the conditions of being hired there was he could do a year-long investigation, an investigative report on death in custody in the United States, and ended up putting together an extraordinary set of stories. I don't know how it didn't win many awards, but the incredible thing was that it actually led to the signing of the Death in Custody Reporting Act. It was because he printed out a bunch of copies of all of the stories and went to Washington and said, I'm not going to leave Washington until I get politicians to care about this. He had connections in Arkansas and with Bobby Scott, who is a representative from Virginia. Bobby Scott and the Hutchinson brothers, Asa and now I'm blanking on his name, his brother, who are from Arkansas, the three of them succeeded in getting the Death in Custody Reporting Act passed in 2000. And Roger, I think I'm going to turn it back to you to talk a little bit about the Death in Custody Reporting Act and why it's not good enough and why we need the public health infrastructure to also pay attention to this problem.
So as you see in this particular depiction, prior to 2000, prior to the work that Mike Masterson was doing to bring attention to death in custody, and he was looking at local jails, state-run jails and prisons, and he was really showing that there was not a coordinated effort to capture data surrounding individuals dying in jails and prisons within the United States. And so this Death in Custody Reporting Act, H.R. 1447, was established back in 2000, and it was established primarily for prison and jails. And you can see that for 3 years, it was moving forward. It actually expired prior to the 2013 reimagination of the law, but they were doing such a good job at it, the Bureau of Justice Statistics. They had over 90% compliance of the jails and prisons. And so there was a good set of data. And I was, you know, consuming that data out of the Bureau of Justice Statistics, or BJS, for those years. In 2013, it gets reintroduced and brought into federal law. And now it has a requirement that has a penalty associated with it. Because of some bureaucratic issues, Bureau of Justice Statistics, or BJA, can no longer be the administrator of this data collection because of the penalty that comes along with it. So it had to be transferred to BJA. Bureau of Justice Assistance. That was the grant-making authority and could also levy some type of penalty for non-compliance. That really led to a dismantling, whether knowingly or not, to the Deaths in Custody Reporting Act. You can see here, and I'm glad that Jay gave us a sneak peek of the second one. 2019, you see suicides. This is just for cause of death from 2001 to 2019, unnatural deaths in state prisons. We won't read the fine print. This can be found online through your searches. But you can see suicides on the rise and is on the rise and really has a steep rise from 2015 to 2019. You could see drug, alcohol, and intoxication from that 2014 push. This is really where fentanyl is hitting all drug supplies in the country. We saw it when I was chief medical examiner in the general population, and we saw it within the incarcerated population in these jails. And then you could see a rise in homicides. The only thing that is leveling off is really the accidents. And so in 2019, we no longer, and if you go back to the last slide, Jay, we no longer have reliable data that's coming out of the federal government. We really never had good arrest-related data that was hit or miss. We had some pretty good jail and prison death data at the heyday of this 20-year stint, but now have none. I just need you to realize how that is. So, and what that means, we do not know today how many people are dying in the custody of our law enforcement and in our criminal legal system. And why is this important? It's because from a public health standpoint, it's important to know why people die. Mortality data is extremely important. Harvard reviewed our book and suggested that we were embarking upon a new type of studies called death equity studies, understanding the impact of mortality on morbidity, right? How people live with disease or injury, and how people access healthcare, access what W.E.B. Du Bois, the five major areas, education, economics, housing, healthcare, and non-disparate criminal justice practices. And we know that access is important when we talk about social determinants of health. And so in the law of the Deaths in Custody Reporting Act, it says the reason why the law has been enacted is because we want to understand how many people are dying and the impact of the criminal legal system on the actual deaths. And that's really a public health mandate. It's within a criminal legal framework or a criminal justice framework, but it's really a public health mandate. Yet the law falls short of asking the public health institutions to generate public health data surrounding death in custody. You can see here the phases of in custody. I want to see the next slide, Jay. You see the phases of in custody. And these phases of in custody is on the continuum from pre-arrest to arrest-related, to incarcerated, to in jail or prison, and even some post-incarcerated deaths. And these deaths can span the five manners. So they're not all homicides. They can be natural or suicides or accident undetermined, but we don't really have a good depiction of these things. The public health infrastructure, our vital statistics, our vital registry, is the organization that tells us who dies. There's two things that we get as Americans in this country that the government gives us and promises us: a birth certificate or death certificate. The rest of it is up for argument, but we get a birth certificate and a death certificate. That death certificate is extremely important for us to understand the deaths that we have in this country. So what is that? How do we know that? Well, if there's any, you know, Black women in the audience or will listen to this in its asynchronous form, then we know that maternal mortality is a big issue, that women of color are dying at a higher rate inside and around those around childbirth. But the reason why we know that is because there's a checkbox on the US standard death certificate that tells us if an individual that died, were they pregnant, were they 42 days within pregnancy, were they a year within pregnancy. Another good example is a lot of time is spent in California, especially, there's a lot of bicyclists. In DC, there's a lot of bike lanes, right? And there's bicyclists and there's vision zero, where we don't want pedestrians to get hit by motor vehicles, right? And we don't, right? And the reason why we know pedestrians are getting hit by motor vehicles or drivers or cyclists or motorcyclists is because there are a series of check boxes for automobile accidents surrounding these deaths on the US standard death certificate. Another example is cancer. The reason why we know smoking is associated with certain cancers because there's a smoking checkbox on the US standard death certificate. So what we're suggesting, to give away the punchline, right? Because the book is full of stories and full of journalist efforts. The podcast is full of stories and full of journalists efforts. But what we say is that it is not enough for the criminal legal system, the criminal justice system on its own to monitor death. We need to use the most robust, the most sought after vital registry system in the world, which is the US vital registration system, to capture those that are dying in custody. And we do that through a checkbox on the local death certificate and the US standard death certificate. Not to replace the work that the Department of Justice is going to do surrounding identifying particular circumstances surrounding death, but to be clear that those certifiers of death like me, board certified forensic pathologist, physician, those coroners, those ICU docs, right? Those doctors that are in the emergency department. Earlier, before we started this work, one of our hosts talked about him not really even knowing that there are some jurisdictions that are seeking the release of that individual that is sick or injured in the hospital so they don't have to report it as a death in custody. Well, if the doctor is signing the death certificate, then the doctor has the framework for those deaths that are in custody. And that framework would include those that are in custody when they are injured or have disease, and therefore they would check that local box. So it's extremely important for us to have the conversation about bringing the public health infrastructure into place to solve this issue. At the center of this wheel of this public health, from assessment to policy development to assurance, is research. The only way we're going to know the burden of disease, the burden of injury that is associated with our criminal legal system is for us to do the research. And the only way we can do the research is the data collection. Right now, it's handfuls of advocates and journalists that are creating databases in Pennsylvania and New Orleans, out there in California, that are pulling together these databases that are separate and apart. And I'll stop here for now. Right now, all of these cases that we're talking about are apparently single travesties. They're single abominations when an individual is dying, like LaShawn Thompson on the floor of a Fulton County jail. Or Earl Faison, or Manny Ellis, or Elijah McClain, and the list goes on and on. But by capturing data, this becomes an analysis of a larger system of issues that can be solved if we can understand the issues that affect individuals across jurisdictions.
Great. I think there's a lot more we could say, but I know I'm cognizant of the time, and I want to make sure that there is enough time for the Q&A. I just wanted to really reiterate that since 2019, the data that we were getting from the mortality and correctional institutions program is no longer available to us because of that bureaucratic problem that Roger described. BJS and BJA are literally across the hall from one another, but the statisticians from BJS are not allowed to go help the Bureau of Justice Assistance collect the data. And now that the relationships between the states and BJS have been severed, the states have decided in many, not all cases, that they no longer need to work hard to collect this data because they know that there's no penalty, and they know that the people who are collecting the data at the federal government really don't know exactly what they're doing. And so we're in a situation like in Pennsylvania, where only 2/3 of the deaths in custody that happen in jails, because we have journalists who are looking at that, get reported to the federal government every year. And the state kind of knows about this, but there's nothing they can do because they can't compel the local agencies to provide them with the data. And there's no penalty if they don't. And so it's a really weird, perverse system, and it's a perverse problem. And we do think that the Death in Custody Reporting Act should be fully implemented and followed. But the history that we tell suggests that over the 100 years that the legal system has been trying to deal with this problem, it hasn't been able to do the job. On the other hand, the public health system that we have does an amazing job, whatever the inadequacies of the system, whatever the politics. We saw that during COVID, the politics of death counts, whatever, you know, we can go off on that if anyone's interested. But the reality is we do have the best vital records collection system in the world, and we should be using it for this problem. We should count what we care about, and we should care about people who are dying in the context of the criminal legal system. So how do we want to handle are there questions from the panel who we can see? Are there questions from the audience? I can ask Roger to talk about some secondary review of autopsies that he's been working on with Colin Kaepernick and the Know Your Rights camp. There's a lot we can talk about. I just want to see if there are specific things that anyone either on the screen with us or in the audience would like us to address.
I want to welcome in our guests and our moderators here, and also invite everybody attending to type any questions in as Robbie's prompted you there. I want to thank Jay and Roger for an excellent set of remarks here, and invite Matt and Michael and Mary to please jump in with questions.
Thank you so much for this wonderful work that you're doing. I think all of us who are involved in this work tend to get somewhat skeptical and even sort of hopeless, because it seems like when we make progress, the other side sort of doubles down on, you know, more secrecy and more killings. So I'm wondering how you all, because I know you've been in this work for, because I've listened to your podcast, which is wonderful, by the way. I highly recommend it. Thanks to Jeremy for passing it on to me. I'm just wondering how you cope with the roadblocks, how you take care of yourselves. And I know that's not a specific question about the work that you're doing, but I think so many of us who are involved in this, we really do have to take care of ourselves. I'm thinking of going into therapy because it is such, you see so little progress. So with that, I'll, Professor Aronson, what do you think?
So I totally agree. I will say that writing this book was absolutely gutting on so many levels. I mean, there were periods where I was crying, and, you know, it was awful on so many levels. But there were moments that actually gave me a ton of hope. And just, you know, part of it was the relationship that I developed with Roger, during the writing of the book. And we talked some about that, during the podcast. And you know, I mean, we became really good friends, and I'm inspired by the work that he's done and what I've learned from him. And I will say that so one little anecdote that I want to share is Roger mentioned that Student National Medical Association paper. That statement has been revised three times, or twice actually. It's in its third edition. And I was searching around, you know, police violence as a public health issue, and I come across this paper that was calling for exactly the kinds of changes that Roger was advocating for, and laid out the issue of death in custody as a public health issue. And it was amazing. And I on the first page, it said, you know, said something about like third edition statement, whatever. So I read the whole thing and I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to share this with Roger. Like, someone's finally caught up to him. And so I was like, I wonder who wrote this thing. So I go back to the first, I scroll back to the first page, and it was, you know, third edition Student National Medical Association. And then it said the first edition written by Dr. Roger Mitchell in 2000. And I think I was probably just a bit emotional at the time, but I was like, I was in tears. I was literally in tears about like how cool this moment was. And then of course I called Roger and, you know, we had a nice moment about it. So that's one thing. The other thing that I'll say is that anyone who's an activist and anyone who's in any kind of advocacy knows that the process is slow, and the better job you're doing of being an advocate, the harder the pushback is and the more resistance you get. If you're doing stuff that nobody cares about, then you can do it because it doesn't affect anyone with power and who's doing bad stuff. But the minute that you're doing things that actually matter, the people who are harming and who are benefiting from whatever problem you're trying to fix are pushing back. In California, you can no longer use the cause of death, excited delirium, on death certificates, in part because of the work that Roger's done. The American Academy of Emergency Physicians has rescinded its stamp of approval of this condition called excited delirium, which is to make a long story short, we talk about it in our book. In the 1980s, several prostitutes were found dead in Miami, and an assistant medical examiner there came up with the theory that because they had cocaine in their system and that they were prostitutes, they were dying because they were having sex with men of their species. These were Black women mostly. And they were having sex that was so vigorous with men of their species that they were overheating, that their bodies lost control of their bodies and they died. Turns out there was a serial killer in the area, and they figured that out. But the idea never expired. Dr. Vincent DiMaio and his wife began to argue that when you see Black men getting into altercations with police, they were dying not because of the actions of the police, but because they had excited delirium, that they developed superhuman strength, and that in order to protect themselves, these cops had to ramp up the level of force that they were using. And so this was a debunked theory soon after it was created, but it has a life. And so Roger and Physicians for Human Rights and many others have been pushing back against this, and we've seen progress there. I will also say that we know a lot more thanks to the work of journalists who I'm friends with, who inspire me. And so we see progress, and we see people within the political sphere and within the police and criminal legal sphere who actually want to do something about it. So as much as I'm depressed and as much as it's horrible, I have seen progress even in the time that I've been involved in this.
Dr. Mitchell, would you care to answer that?
Well, I'm a man of faith. I wear that proudly. I'm a minister of the gospel. And so I find my strength in that relationship. I'm married to a phenomenal, brilliant woman for the last 21 years, and we enjoy our family, and I gain strength from that. But I'm a forensic pathologist, so I see failed policy on my table as a function of the system. So whether that failed policy is an addiction or whether it's in domestic violence or whether it's in violence or whether it's in cancer, or I'll see it on my table, and my job is to diagnose it in a way that allows for providers of healthcare delivery and or attorneys and policymakers and law enforcement to use that data in a way that decreases the burden of the disease and injury on society. So I provide that responsibility. And so I can't say that I'm used to it, but I'm used to it. And then I'm a Black man in the United States of America. So this, and my triple great grandmother was lynched because she got smart with a white woman in Southern Georgia at the turn of the century. So this abuse of our community is not a new construct. We are on a ever still continuum of abuse of community. And so what we've done here is I'm trying to sterilize this, right? Sterilize the conversation and move the emotion that comes with racism out of it. And let's just talk about the facts. Let's talk about the data. Let's talk about the historical context. And if you really look at it, you know, we were just, Jay and I just gave a talk at the Pennsylvania Prison Society. It was phenomenal. It was well attended. We were in Pennsylvania. They were excited about it. They bought some books. It was great. And this old white woman comes up to me at the end of the panel. And she said, "I just want to know what I can do to help. Can I just help? It seems like no one's listening and I want to help." And I said, "Okay, well, why do you want to help?" "Because my son is in prison and he has a brain tumor and they don't want to operate on it." And so this older white woman, just as sweet as pie, the concept in this country would make you believe that she could never have a son that was in jail or prison, that would need equity in healthcare delivery for his brain tumor. But the reality of it is that this issue that we're facing is not a Black or white issue. I mean, I'm sure if when the data comes back for real, that Black people and brown people are suffering at a higher rate. Of course, this is America. But that's not an absence of poor white people suffering in our jails and prisons. And so this conversation that we're having is being picked up. I mean, I've been at it for 25 years and I'm now, you know, amongst elite professors talking about it, right? It's being picked up. There's a lot of things happening at the American Bar Association, the National Medical Association. Matter of fact, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine is looking at this issue. I don't want to spill the beans on any of that, but there's work that's happening that's moving this forward. And so we wanted you to be engaged. We want you to call your local legislator and say, "Hey, let's have hearings on death in custody. Hey, let's talk about putting a checkbox on the local state death certificate. Hey, you just banned excited delirium in California. Let's go a step further. Let's track all deaths in California that's associated with the criminal legal system. Let's have fatality review committees, just like infant fatality and maternal mortality. Let's get that legislated and have that at a county level to know how many people are dying at the hands are associated with the criminal legal system." So there's something that your listeners can do and that you can do and your students can do to move this forward.
So if I can jump in there were a few questions in the Q&A about how people can really advocate at a local and national level. And I think Roger started to provide some of the answers. I think one of the best things that you can do is you can advocate your local leaders to try and get a checkbox on the California state death certificate. the vagaries of doing it at the national level are quite complicated, and as we all know, the politics are our political system sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. That's all I'll say. But you have much more power and influence in your own state, so I would start there and work with your state reps and your state senators and the state public health infrastructure. I think that's the that's what I would do first. As far as someone mentioned COVID, and I think that the death certificate is the best way of dealing with that problem in terms of understanding who's dying from particular diseases in custody. Roger was involved in actually activating the vital record system to track COVID deaths, and it's amazing how quickly we were able to ramp that up. And again, you know, there are issues with how we categorized COVID deaths and all of those kinds of things, but we were able to get over 90% of all COVID deaths on the death certificate in a very short period of time. And so there's lots of advocacy work that can be done on the carceral healthcare system, but it starts from actually knowing who's dying and what they're actually dying from. And so I'd like to see that, you know, I'd like to see that data being available to public health practitioners, to medical practitioners, and to advocates, so we can all figure that out. So I think we've run out of time.
Just one really quick last question. What does the box say? Is it just a simple died in custody or not, or is there something more involved?
So the box would say death in custody, yes or no. And then it would say pre-arrest, arrest, incarcerated / jail. And so those would be the three sub boxes. So it would be similar to the motor vehicle checkbox, yes, because the motor vehicle and the pregnancy checkbox on the death certificate has a master checkbox and then has a couple subs. That would be the best situation. In DC, when we put the box on, we could only get death in custody, yes, no, or unknown. And so that would even suffice, even if we can't get it into the phases, yes or no. And that actual box in DC has to be checked on every single case. So the checkbox has to be, so it forces you can't go any further without an active checking of that box. And invariably, the majority of the deaths, you're checking no, but for the subset. And a team, a group of us are working on publishing the data that's coming off the DC checkbox. Hopefully that'll be out by late spring, early summer.
So this is not generated by the PD, but the coroner, the boxes.
Well, so the box would be on the death certificate. So okay, those individuals, it will be on the local death certificate. So they will see the primary doc, whoever the doctor is signing the death certificate would see that box and be able to check it based upon where that person dies. So if it is a injury that's causing death in most jurisdictions, particularly in California, the coroner, sheriff, coroner, or medical examiner will be signing those death certificates. Keep in mind, in California, you still have a remnant sheriff coroner system. And your governor just shot down a bill that would have abolished the sheriff coroner system, because I was part of that work. So you still have coroners who are sheriffs of the jails where the deaths are occurring that would be required, that are still required to certify those deaths. And there's obviously an apparent conflict of interest and perceptions of bias, even where bias doesn't exist. And in forensic medicine, we like to suggest that you need to remove bias even if it doesn't exist, even if there's a perception of such.
Mm-hmm. I know we need to go. The only thing I wanted to add is that the checkbox is the first step in the process of using that data to figure out what's going on. We need death review panels in addition to the checkbox.
And if we could just take a couple minutes extra, just in case Matt and Mike have a question or a comment. My question was what you just answered, Roger. I wanted to highlight the California that outrageous situation that was highlighted in the podcast. But Mike and Matt, if you want to jump in, and also I want to just click answer live so that Corinne Nichols' excellent comment goes over so that attendees can read that too.
Oh,
it's a really terrific a comment about other ways that neglect and things like that can slip through the cracks. So I'm going to move that over to the format so that attendees can read her excellent point. But Matt and Mike, please jump in, and then we'll move toward wrapping up.
I just wanted to say thank you to both of you for your work and for your willingness to participate even from across oceans and continents. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I also just wanted to say thank you, Dr. Mitchell. I don't want to keep you much later. I know that it's very late where you are, but thank you so much. We'll probably go on for another hour at least.
Well, listen, this is so important. Jay and I have, you know, spent a lot of time. We started writing this book back in 2017. We started writing it before, you know, there was a lot of attention. This is before George Floyd. We started writing this book. And so this is something that was on our minds and in our hearts to work on. It's just that it's as relevant today as it was 25 years ago. And quite frankly, it is as relevant today as it was when Ida B. Wells was talking about it. And so, you know, Jay and I now are in that fray of being willing to have these conversations about what the government can do to make sure that we're tracking, you know, preventable deaths in our system, where particularly in an environment where we cannot move or have our freedom and require healthcare delivery and require food and require water from someone else. So we should at least be tracking how that's going. You know, Jay is often very vocal about this is just the beginning. And quite frankly, he's not convinced that we can reform the system. And quite frankly, this is the beginning of showing that we need to completely reimagine our criminal justice system in a way that shows equity, in a way that centers community and centers humanity. And so I've learned so much from him in his approach to this. And so we don't want to let you guys go without telling you that Official Ignorance has been nominated for an NAACP Image Award this year. And so there's an opportunity for you to go on that Image Award and vote for us and vote for the podcast. Please listen to it. But we want to, by winning an Image Award, it would just bring that many more people to this conversation and hopefully the decision makers that can start moving some of the solutions that we put forward in the book and in the podcast forward.
Yeah, I'm just going to, before we leave, I'm going to paste the instructions into the chat for how to go and vote. I also wanted, am I allowed to plug some upcoming Southern California events?
So you're allowed to do anything you want to do.
Okay.
Time.
Someone got to it before me. Awesome. I will be at UC Irvine on May 14th. I don't know the exact details yet. I think the Department of Sociology and also Law and Criminology. And then we'll be at UCLA together on May 15th. And we'll make sure to get you that information. So if anyone is either out in Orange County or able to get to UCLA, that'd be great. The other thing the last thing that I wanted to say before we leave is that death is still a relatively rare occurrence in the criminal legal system, but each death is a representative of a tremendous amount of harm and trauma that occurs. And that's something that I've learned. There are so many near misses on a daily basis in the context of policing and also in our carceral facilities. I visit a prison here in Western Pennsylvania, And I was chatting with one of the administrators, and I asked about, hey, I heard that there was an OD here. And I meant that someone had died from an overdose. And her kind of off the cuff response to me was, oh, that happens all the time. And I knew that, but it just kind of hit me. And I was talking to a guy who was incarcerated about the hooch that they make and how it sometimes goes bad. And, you know, these things are regular occurrences, but they don't often lead to deaths. And we're studying deaths, not because we just care about people who die, but we actually want to keep people alive. And we want to highlight all of the harm that takes place. And death is just something that happens that it's harder to hide than a near miss. And so I just wanted to make that last point that for each death, there's a tremendous amount of harm and trauma that that's sort of lurking in the background and in the shadows. And thank you so much for having us. It's awesome to be able to get the message out. It's great to see Roger, even when he's an ocean away. It's great to meet all of you, and hopefully we'll see at least a couple of you in May when we're actually out there for real.
Thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and thank you for being our guest today. You were wonderful.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, everybody. Right. Thank you. Have a good
Have a good
evening.
Afternoon. Good
Thanks.
Night, Roger.
See ya. Good night, Roger.
Bye.